We'll get serious about Poetry Month today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Dodd Wooten. Poetry Month is in full gear, so we'll shift into cruising speed for it today. And I'm sure Garrison Keillor will contribute a poem on the Writer's Almanac on Scribble. This is your time, Roald.
Well,
Poetry Month.
Yes, and I have been waiting for this particular month because I have a couple of questions that I want to ask all of our poets. I've been asking people for the past 2 months, first of all, whether poetry has any obligations. Is a poet, when a poet sits down to write, does that poet have any obligations to anyone other than the poem? And conversely, does the poet have any business going into, are there areas where the poet ought not to travel? You know, the ministers are warned, politics and the pulpit don't mix.
Yeah.
Do politics and poetry mix?
Of course.
Well, you think they do?
Well, with Shakespeare they do. Look at the Henry plays.
Well, the thing is, I've been asking people for probably the last month, people who write poetry and people who are interested in poetry, that question: Can poets be political? And there's about a 50-50 split between yes and no.
I have a thing here from Garrison Keillor.
All right.
Which I read last week when Rebecca Wee was my guest on Saturday Morning Live. But I thought this was too good to pass up for Scribble. April is National Poetry Month, a painful reminder for some who suffered under English teachers who made them write about the cherry tree wearing white for Eastertide, or the love song of J. Alfred Pruneface by T.S. Eliot, that small dark cloud of a poet. We all suffered under English teachers who forced us to pretend to be sensitive and to sigh with appreciation over the plums in the icebox so sweet and so cold, and that is why reading poetry aloud has been shown time and time again to be effective at breaking up gatherings of people. Many police departments now use Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass instead of pepper spray. We resisted poetry in school because we could see that it is full of falsehood. Love is not the star to every wandering bark, and many true minds have married who should have stayed friends. April is not the cruelest month. March is. The best minds of our generation are not starving, hysterical, naked. Most of them are well-fed, calm, and stylishly dressed, thank you. Robert Frost's Little Horse was absolutely right. It is queer to stop without a farmhouse near the darkest evening of the year. Dishonesty has given poetry a bad reputation. You see that uneven right margin and you think, oh boy, here we go again, Hallucinationville. So I'm not suggesting that you sit down and read poems for Poetry Month, but that you should write your own poem for someone whom you dearly love. A love is never easy to express. Rage is simple. Loneliness, despair, a child could do it. And they do, especially preschoolers. But love is a challenge, especially for men. Men are wired for combat, to bash the enemy into submission. And it's hard to wipe the blood and gore off your hands and sit down and write, O wondrous thou, the wonderment of these my happiest days, I lift my pen to praise thy shining beauty, and so forth. But you can do it. The first step is imitate. Google great love poems and find one you like a lot and copy and paste it onto a blank page. Burns' My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose, or Stevenson's I Will Make You Brooches and Toys for Your Delight, or Yeats' Wine Comes In at the Mouth and Love's Come In at the Eye. and simply change the nouns. For example, my love is like a double bed, or a trip to town, a vision pure, a red T-shirt. I will make you coffee and serve by candlelight. I come in the front stores and love comes down from upstairs. And then go on to plug in new verbs and adverbs, prepositions. It's like remodeling an old house. If you were very ambitious, you would take off from Shakespeare's famous sonnet 29, when in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, and rewrite that. The first 8 lines are about how dreary and hopeless you feel. The last 6 about how you feel exalted by her love. Simple. Keep the rhymes. Eyes, cries, state, fate, hope, scope, possess the great Midwest, and replace the rest. Write the poem in black ink on a sheet of white paper. Poems should never be sent by email, and never, never, never text a poem. Hand it to her, and as she reads it, put one hand on her shoulder so that you're right there when she turns with tears in her eyes to embrace you and forgive you for every way you've messed up her life. This is the power of poetry. Poets get the girl. Football heroes get concussions or need hip replacements. My classmates who played football are walking with canes and moaning when they sit down, and they find it hard to figure out the 10% tip at lunch. We poets go sashaying along, perpetually 17, lost in wonder at the ordinary, astonished by street lights, in awe of lawn ornaments, bedazzled by baristas releasing steam into milk for the lattes. This is what you learn during Poetry Month. You may lose the vote, fall into debt, suffer illness and remorse, feel lost in the crowd, and yet there is in language, everyday language, a source of such sweet delight that when you turn it to a good purpose, 2 gentle arms may reach around your neck, just as is happening to me right now. And a familiar voice speaks the word I long to hear, and my heart is going like mad, and yes, I say, yes, I will, yes.
Well, there's a turnaround.
That's pretty good, isn't
that
it?
That is very good. I don't know that we need to say anything more.
Well, I use my time, not your turn.
Well, what got me going on this question, and incidentally, one of the things, as I've been looking around, I discovered about poetry and politics is that your favorite poet, who is Edna St. Vincent Millay, I'm assuming, aside from Shakespeare.
Yes, yes, I like her very much.
Do you know how she spent the war years?
I'm trying to remember now. I read her biography, but it's a blank. Was she nursing or something in a munitions factory, or what'd she do?
She was an employee of an organization I had never heard of called the Writers' War Board. She and other poets were hired by the U.S. government to write propaganda poetry for the war effort.
Amazing.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is.
And I've read some of the poems that she's written, and they aren't the usual propaganda. She believed what she was writing, but these are works of literature that were intended to aid the war effort for the Allies.
And you wonder how poetry can do that.
Well, or whether it should. And as I said, I've gotten yeses and noes from almost everybody I've asked. No, poetry has no business in politics. Pastors shouldn't be political from the pulpit, et cetera, et cetera. Because poetry is not that kind of... Even the way Garrison Keillor ends that, right, he stays away from politics. What got me going on this was a book that, among the dozens of books that Nan Carter sends me from San Francisco, a couple of months ago, was an anthology of about 100 poems called El Mutanabi Street Starts Here. El Mutanabi Street, it turns out, is a street in Baghdad, curving street that curves up about 3 blocks from the Tigris River, in which 95% of all the bookstores and booksellers and scribes in Baghdad are located. It's the Street of Booksellers, it's called. It began in the very year that Baghdad began in 732, and it has always been the street, not in 732 for booksellers, but for scribes who would write down books or write letters for you and so forth. And even today, it is a street where there are several legitimate bookstores, there are book stalls, there are book kiosks, there are rugs laid out by book merchants, and they put their used books on the ground in on the street. It is where books are bought and sold, and in fact, you can buy almost any book you can think of. Editor of this volume was able to find Mark Twain there, Huckleberry Finn, and Tom Sawyer. You can buy banned books, banned for religious reasons, banned for political reasons. You can buy books from around the world as well as by Arabic writers. What happened was that on March 5th, 2007, a car bomb went off in Mutanabe Street, which was generally considered safe because it was so small and so isolated and out of the way. 30 people were killed, 100 wounded, and all sorts of books, including a couple of full bookstores, were blown to pieces, and there were books, leaves of books burning and flying every which way. And this book, Al-Mutanabi Street starts here, is a book by a couple of San Francisco editors, Bo Bosalel and Dima Shihabi, who solicited responses to this bombing from poets around the world. And so this anthology has a dozen or so American poets. It has a lot of Iraqi poets. It has Iraqis who live on Mutanabe Street. And it is this response after that response after that response to this particular bombing. So it really, for me, raised the question about, in a world that is becoming nastily political, whether poetry has any obligation to participate, or does it have an obligation to stay pure and away from it all? And the answer, the problem is, right, the people who put the car bomb there aren't going to be reading this.
No, not right? at all.
You're preaching to the choir. Yeah. So first of all, of what value is it to even respond in a poem? Because you're not going to change things. The car bombings are going to go on. In fact, they always have. When it turns out, Mutanabe Street, this isn't the first disaster on Mutanabe Street. In 1258, when the Mongol hordes overtook Iraq and over Baghdad, they first of all killed 200,000 people and threw their bodies into the Tigris River, which it was said ran red for days. And then they took every single book on Al-Mutanabi Street and threw the book into the water, which they said then turned black from the ink from all the books. That was done again when the Ottoman Empire overtook Baghdad. It was done again when the British overtook Baghdad and took some of the banned books. It was done again when the dictator in Iraq took over and hunted down banned books, and it was done again with the American occupation. Books are always being hit in. Right?
That's because ideas are in books. And if you have one idea, you don't want any competition from other ideas. If you have one emotion, rage, anger, vengeance, you don't want that weakened by any other emotion. That's the problem with people of dictatorial bent. They do not want any opinion or action but their own. And that has always been the problem of the world. It's the men get this way, you know.
Well, and even here in 1917, I don't remember the exact date, there was a big burning of German books over in Davenport.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So we're not immune from it either. And it turns out that, you know, Hitler and the Nazi regime gets a lot of press for all the art they stole. It turns out they did the same thing to at least 100 million books, destroyed yeah. many of them, stole many others, rare books and so forth. But books are always suspect. Fahrenheit 451, the book burning, if you've read that particular book.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow books and poetry seems to survive. But still, the answer is, you know, what can it do? And even among poets, there are two different answers. For Shelley, right? Shelley has that famous line, "Poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world." But then here comes W.H. Auden and simply says, frankly, poetry makes nothing happen. And yet, Auden is the one who wrote that great World War II poem, September 1st, 1939. "I sit in one of the dives on 32nd Street, uncertain and afraid, as the clever hopes expire of a low, dishonest decade." And it goes on to talk about how could this have happened.
I think what you do, especially in poetry, is to take what is intense in you and put it in a more permanent form so that it doesn't get away from you and that it's there for others to share. But, you know, poets, well, who is it, Keats? Somebody went to war for Greece.
Byron.
Byron, that was it. Byron went to war for Greece. You think, wait a minute, you're a poet. What are you doing here? And I guess you look at the war poets. I have a CD of war poems written by British soldiers in the trenches, as well as some people back home. Two CDs of beautiful poems. I don't know that there's an answer to your question, Roel.
Well, that's why I think it will be good to look at the three or four poets we have coming up and see what they say. I do have a couple of poems I'd like to read from El Mutanabbi Street Starts Here. The answer to the question, where does Mutanabbi Street start? It starts here in San Francisco. It starts here in Davenport. It mm-hmm. starts wherever you are, because there is always a books are always a threat. They're always being burned. And somehow they're always rising above the ashes.
Okay, you page through that. And right now we'll take a moment and turn the microphone over to Garrison Keillor. Instead of just reading the stuff that he has written, we'll give him a chance to speak for himself. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. And now you have selections from that marvelous, what is the name of the book again?
El Mutanabbi Street Starts Here. It's the anthology responding to the car bombing on the street of booksellers in Baghdad. The first poem I want to read is Remnants by Dilara Circuit. I don't know anything about her, but here it is. Under Middle Eastern stars, fire ravages yellowed texts, chars centuries of thought bound in ancient leather. As smoke twists to the sky, crumbling ideas wither to ash. A bookseller blinks back tears, hands clasped in quiet prayer. Burnt pages of poetry, history, philosophy litter empty streets. Memories seep through earth to revive the city's heart. So apparently what a poem can do is witness, right?
That is the big thing.
It can't save the world. It can't save even the books, but it can witness.
Right.
And that's, I think, what nearly all of the poems here do. Here's another one called Words by Susie Malcolm. Thinkers and writers and readers who found solace in those bookstalls knew the hope of turning pages in a world of terror and walls. So when the browsers were bombed with Baghdad books torn and bloody in the dust, they broke the hearts of humankind, but not the poet's trust. That words blown like birds in the killing won't die in a smoking sky, that out of harm's reach, freed fragments of speech will one day find reason and fly. I like that one.
Very nice. And that was a wonderful idea to have poets contribute to this project.
Yeah, I don't know who got there were all sort around the world, there were broadsides printed. Mm-hmm. Some of these are from individual broadsides that the poets themselves have printed, but it did alarm the writing world, that bombing on, you know, there are many bombings in Baghdad, but this one just seemed symbolic to them, and
well,
they felt
because,
they had to respond.
You know, language is really the thing that changes us. Language is what we have that is special. I used to tell my students, if you don't know words, you probably can't think. It's the way you use those words, the way you put them together. You know, that means your mind is working. You can express yourself. And you begin to find out. I tell people, I never know what I'm going to say until I hear it. I never know what I think until I articulate it. That's facile.
Lots of writers say that.
Yeah,
how do I know what I think until I say it?
That's right. And when you put it in words, then it becomes real in a way. And that reality is one of the hallmarks of being a human being. So that's why you want everybody to write.
And particularly this month, why don't you try to write a poem? Doesn't have to even be political.
I wrote one.
I know you did, and I've been trying to write a response, but I can't find the last line of the limerick.
Seeing Tweet dressed in a tuxedo made his friends all shout, "Oh, neato." We feared that we might.
That's sick, Don. That's really sick.
We feared that we might encounter the sight of him dressed up in a Speedo.
That's verse. That's not poetry.
That's a limerick. Get off my back. That's very good. But do we have any time here? Not much. John Dombeck writes poems.
Oh, does he?
Yes. And I just ran across one called I Will Miss the Stars.
All right.
Just as my eyes are closing for the final time, perhaps while watching the sublime wonder of the Milky Way's endless displays of galaxies and stars, I will know this fading glance is my final dance with everything I know. I've been told not to regret that I go. Rejoice. I will become one in the incomprehensible mystery, saturated in joy awaiting me. Perhaps so. Still, I will miss the stars.
That's good.
Yeah, I think that's very nice. Johnny surprises you that way. He writes poetry a lot, and I've collected them. And I just ran across this one. I thought, okay, we're talking about poems. I'll give Johnny a shout out. And here's my favorite of all time. Why should the devil get all the good tunes, the booze and the neon and Saturday night, the swaying in darkness, the lovers like spoons? Why should the devil get all the good tunes? Does he hum them to while away sad afternoons and the long lonesome Sundays, or sing them for spite? Why should the devil get all the good tunes, the booze and the neon and Saturday night? That's a poem by A.E. Stallings that I rather like. And with that, I think we'll put a cap on it today. The next three Saturdays, we'll be talking to local poets, and we urge you to become one. Write your own poem. This is Poetry Month, so join in with the gang, and Roald and I will be back to help celebrate Poetry Month with you next week on Scribble.